Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new motorsport podcast series. I'm Ed Foster, and this time we're turning our attention to Porsche. The series is called Porsche's Winning Formula. Ever since Ferdinand Porsche designed the Volkswagen Beetle in 1939, 8 years after launching his eponymous company in 1931, Porsche has been at the forefront of vehicle design. While the Pretty 356 was the first car to carry the Porsche name in the late 1950s, many of you will automatically think of the 911 that arrived over 10 years later, arguably the most successful sports car of all time. The model is still being built nearly 60 years later. In those years, Porsche has won the Le Mans 24 Hours more than any other manufacturer. It's been victorious in Formula One, both as a constructor and an engine supplier, and it's won countless GT championships with its beloved 911. Porsches have even done rallycross and rallying. In this special podcast series, we are going to speak to the racers that are at the forefront of the German manufacturer's racing development and key names from the road car side to get a better idea of how this great company has had so much success for so long.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast. This is another one in our Porsche series called Porsche's Winning Formula, and it is in partnership with the British luxury yacht manufacturer Princess Yachts. Good morning, Jochen Mass. Welcome back to the Motorsport Podcast.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much.
I don't know if you remember, but the last one we did together was 2016 at Goodwood with Rob Widdows. And actually, I listened to it again the other day, and we spent most of the time laughing. And I see you're armed with the glass of Prosecco already. So I'm looking forward to the next hour.
That's just to enhance the laughter.
So every time we do a podcast with you, we always get hundreds of readers' questions in. So I've yet again, we've got loads of readers' questions in. So I will endeavour to ask as many as possible. But I thought, last time we sort of talked about your early career, the Capris, you know, the hill climbs and how you got into racing. But this podcast is sort of mostly about Porsche. When was your first contact with Porsche?
It was 1976, apparently. They gave me an invite, and I saw them in the old Weissach. You know, just thinking back of the company, there were wooden sheds. I mean, it was fantastic. There was nothing much of Weissach. Weissach, the track was there, and but that was it. And the offices were wooden shacks. I mean, it was fantastic. Not shacks, I mean, they were houses, if you like. I mean, they were decent inside. But that's what it was, very simple and very modest. So I thought, that's interesting, Porsche. You know, it's not like Mercedes or Ferrari or whatever you knew. Even Alfa Romeo was a more established sort of looking company in terms of racing. And now Porsche was quite an experience. I mean, I came from Ford, and then Ford was pretty much upset that I signed for Porsche. I said, but guys, you have touring cars. You don't do much else. You don't help me much in Formula One with the engines and so on because of circumstance and things like that. So Ford was very much bent on Formula One in the UK, of course, the McLaren and of course, Chapman, the Lotus. And, you know, so it was. And Tyrrell, of course, Jackie Stewart, Tyrrell. So that was much more important than this young upcoming German, you know, who also would like to have access to some better engines, but you know, it's all snow from yesterday. So we don't really, it's been melting my brain ever since. So it's, no, Yeah, that was nice. So anyway, so I got this invitation from Porsche, and I signed for them. And to me, it was, I'm a Porsche works driver. It was a big thing because Porsche, after all, was a big name in motorsport. And it made me proud to be invited and to be signed on as a works driver. So it reflected some of the quality I possessed. That's on top. But it was good.
But before, yeah. You know, in 1976, this was before, you know, we think of Porsche now, the most successful manufacturer at Le Mans. But really, yes, it had won Le Mans, but it was nowhere near where it is today. So was it, in your mind, was it not a gamble at all? Porsche, even then, was kind of one of the places to be for sports car racing.
Oh, Porsche needed me badly to make it better. No, I'm joking. But of course, you know, as Porsche finally was hell-bent to make it, you know, you had the super sports cars, the 917s, in all sort of configurations, fantastic cars, but they were a little bit too removed from the European race scene. So our sports cars were a little bit more modest. You know, we had the 936 just coming then in carbon fiber, can you believe it? So the body was carbon and so on. So, and then we had, of course, the 935s, which were developed, and the 934s, which I didn't think much because it was more or less a road car, and so on. So that was quite interesting. But Porsche obviously had the desire to make Porsche closer to the public's to the public availability. I mean, they could buy these cars and they could run them. And that was an important factor, you know. So a lot of teams bought Porsche race cars, you know, 936s, not so much, a few of them. And all the 911 based cars, the 935s, they were in great shapes and sizes and sponsorships and whatever in private hands. So that was nice. It was good to see. And so that made racing, it carried racing then, because it was Porsche and Porsche and Porsche. And there were not many others who could compete against them. And even the customers groaned, you know, they said, yeah, but we also have the same car as you, presumably, but they're not as exactly the same as your cars. We said, we know nothing about it. Said, I thought we had the same, and so on. So, you know, we could live with it, Jackie and I, Jackie Hicks. We could live with this sort of fact that we had of naturally coming from the factory. We had the best cars. You know, we had whatever there was developed and it was proven better, we had it first. So only fair, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, the works team should always be the one most likely to win. Did you, I mean, obviously not in period, but have you driven 917s?
The 917 I never drove, no. The first time, in fact, I drove a 917 30 was in Goodwood.
Really?
I never had a chance to drive it, and I never had any particular desire because in the beginning, the 917 coupes, the coupes, they were too early for me. I wasn't quite in that league yet. You know, I just started with Alfa Romeo and with Ford saloon cars and so on. So that was a little bit beyond me. I would have loved to have driven the 908-3 and, if possible, at the Targa Florio and races like that. That was something very desirable for me. And unfortunately, I was also a little bit too late for that, you know, sort of in my race career.
Yeah. In terms of racing, do you slightly wish that you were born kind of 20, 30 years earlier? Because I always think that your kind of approach to life and racing and the cars that, you know, talking there about the 908 and things like that, would you prefer to race them than something like the 962 and 956, which I know I think you're a fan of?
Had I been born that much earlier, I think I would have been killed in the war. You know, that's it would have probably joined the Luftwaffe or joined the submarines or something like that, and that would have been a no-no.
So, I did preface it. You're racing.
Ten years would have done me fine. You know, 10 years earlier or 5 years earlier would have been good.
Yeah.
I mean, don't forget, I was quite late when I started racing, so I could have started earlier already, but because I wasn't a merchant navy, so we don't have to repeat that. So I didn't do it. But till it finally sort of blossomed in my imagination that I could do it, that I should do it, I was quite old. So it was just one of these things. A lot of guys had similar fates, especially then. Lafitte was also, he started when he was 28. So can you imagine? And now he's nearly 90. He made it. Yeah.
The you know, one of your kind of, I suppose, your favorite tracks, the Nürburgring, you had so many great results there, whether that was in a V6 Capri or whether that was in Formula One, when really you probably should have won there twice. What is it about the Nürburgring that you like so much? Because on the other hand, another fast circuit, Le Mans, you didn't actually really like that so much.
Le Mans, let's say, I had a grudge against the Automobile Club de l'Ouest. Now, I'm saying that now, sort of so many years back. But in the beginning, when I joined them, it was 72, the first race I did. And it was, unfortunately, the last race for Joachim Bonnier, who got killed in that race. And I thought, a good guy, a lovely man. I had met him before at Jackie Stewart's house in Switzerland and so on. And I really regretted these sort of happenings. And I felt, I loved Le Mans as a track. What I didn't like were the pits, the safety in terms of guardrail fixation and all that. That was not good. And there was quite an arrogant attitude within the, you know, this sort of FIA independent automobile club. They were older than the FIA and so on. And to them, they could do what they wanted and so on. And they were pretty deaf for some suggestion from drivers and to make it somewhat safer, because we had lost a driver every single year and probably some marshals as well, which you didn't hear much about. But so that was the beginning, Le Mans, and the pits were very narrow and it was, I mean, you drove hard and you tried to get away from the bunch you were with and trying to get a bit of a cushion. And then you came to the pits, and then Marshall held you when you wanted to leave again. He held you because there was a car, you were, let's say, on the upper end, closer to the exit of the pits. And on the bottom end, a car came in. And this car, you couldn't see it because of the lights often. He just held you because that car probably went past you, just ahead of you. But he probably parked sort of the pits before you and things like that. So it was, Jackie nearly went onto the throat of one 1 year. He was so upset about it and so on. And this sort of things I didn't like much. That's why Le Mans to me was a race which I disliked only because of this automobile club, really. It was not the track as such. Mm. You know, the safety was not good. We know that. But I loved the high speeds and I loved, you know, the way it ran. And it was quite fascinating, especially, you know, we didn't do this Maison Blanche corners and so on. So we had the chicanes already in 72. And it was slightly rerouted. So you didn't run behind a wall. There was a big wall now. And there was still the old road running there. And there was this little Maison Blanche, the White House, not the American one, but the Le Mans one, a small one. And, you know, that was, and then he had this long corner going over the Dunlop brow and so on. So we still had that, but of course we had less speed. We carried less speed. And that the old track was even faster because you went flat out most of the time. So it was a bit better, but I liked the Dunlop brow and I liked the left, right hand on the bottom and then the right hand again onto the straight. And, it was nice. That I really liked as a venue to race on. But you know, anyway, so Nürburgring was completely different, obviously, and the Nürburgring had a different melody. You know, when you drove it, it was it was, you had to settle in and you had to be able to drive like Le Mans 2, but it was much more complicated than Nürburgring. You had to drive it in your head before, you know, with the eyes closed and with a stopwatch in your hand, and you started and then you drove your mind the whole Nürburgring. And if you were within 10 seconds, you knew you had it. You know, you were set for the Nürburgring. That was nice. I mean, I drove it the first time, I think in 67, a few 80 laps or so, a friend's car. And
friend's car.
Yeah. But so I really had imbibed it. I mean, it was part of me. The Nürburgring was, I really liked it because, you know, watching it. I mean, I watched the 6 hours or the 4 hours or whatever, 1,000 kilometers touring cars, the Alphas, some early Porsche 911s also raced there, and those Hesemanns and so on. But they were good, obviously, but there weren't so many at the time. And there were the BMWs, of course, the 1800 and the 2 liter TIs. And it was Hubert Hahne and Andrea de Adamic and Ceccoli and Fascetti and Giunti and all these Italian drivers who were fantastic with the Alphas. And I was an Alpha man because I worked for Alpha then. And I really liked the cars. So it was very satisfying to drive for the Nürburgring. You know, you knew exactly when you had the jumps, you know, where the cars took off a little bit and then landed, and then you could just take it in a nice double right-hander and make it one and sliding a little bit. And it was, to me, totally harmless. It was just exciting. But it didn't give me any fear or whatever, or sort of worries about this or that. No, it was, you had to take it in your thing. And, you know, the car bounced a little bit here or there because the road was not as smooth as it is now, of course. It was quite bumpy. So when we drove with the 956s and the 962s, you had exactly 2 moments on the whole 22 kilometers where you could watch your instruments. Other than that, you were only focused on the road in front of you. Rev limiter was on your ears. You never looked at a rev limiter. You know, you knew roughly where you had to change because that's where you were on the track. But you drove in the middle of the road trying to find the entry for the next corner already. You know, give it the most, just going to the right or to the left edge of the road to make it for the corner. And it was incredible. But it was very satisfying. To me, one good lap at Nürburgring was nearly the whole race on some other circuit. So that was good. And I think most people felt the same.
So there's Neil Wooding here. In 1983, Jochen would have been joint champion with X if Porsche hadn't changed lineups for Le Mans. How did the Le Mans pairings come about? And was the decision made pre-season? Was he happy to drive with Beloff? And this is, did you not have as part of your contract that you wouldn't race at Le Mans?
Yeah, sure. I put it in my contract with Porsche. I said, please, I do not want to do Le Mans. And I gave him all the reasons. I said, it's not that I fear anything for my safety or whatever. I just wanted to make a protest to force the race directory to make it safer and to make it a bit smarter and so on, and do away with all these sort of too antique situations like the pits and so on. So that's why. And they said, but please, you have to come anyway because you will be our reserve driver. I said, no, I know where that ends. So I drove it anyway. But, you know, usually in the second or the third car, and often cars which were already slightly injured. And so I was driving those on 5 cylinders sometimes. And when I had one crash with a 936, I followed the Renault, and the Porsche was handling very well. And in the Porsche corners, I was going really fast, you know, for what the car could do on 5 cylinders. But I could get closer to the Renault again. It was Chabouille. And so I enjoyed that. I was just playing, you know, I was joking. And then I spun around hectically and I hit the Amco backwards. Not too bad, but anyway, enough to do the critical damage to the car. and so on. So, you know, that's what happened too, of course. But it was not real racing for me then. It was just sort of a, okay, I've sat in this car or that car as a substitute for somebody or just helping along. While Jackie, of course, you know, if he changed car, he jumped into the leading car. They put him into the leading car because they wanted him to win, which is fair enough. I mean, he was a bloody good driver in Le Mans, and he was always a good driver. But so it was interesting. I never got that because I didn't work myself into this position that they said, okay, Mas also deserves it, and he could be blah, blah. No, that didn't happen. But it was my fault, nobody else's.
And in reference to Neil's question, in 83, you would have been joint champion with X if Porsche hadn't changed the lineups for Le Mans. Was that because of what you've just been saying in terms of you not really wanting to do Le Mans going along as a reserve?
Well, that's the reason, of course. That's why Derek Bell came in and drove with Jackie.
Yeah.
So normally we would have always driven Le Mans as well, together, Jackie and I, because we got on very well on all the other races. And because I said I didn't want to, so they choose Derek. And Derek was good anyway, so it was fine.
Yeah. There's quite an amusing one here about a T-shirt. James Atkinson was wondering whether you once wore a T-shirt saying, "I'm stuck with Bell" on it.
What? Sorry, I didn't get that.
Apparently you once wore a T-shirt that said, "I'm stuck with Bell."
Oh, I see.
Is that true?
No, I never got that one.
No, I'm sorry, James. Well, maybe we can get one of those made up, and then you can wear it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the 956 and the 962, because obviously the 917, the 935, the 936, Moby Dick are kind of put Porsche very much on the sports car map. But really, for me, the 956 and 962 is what cemented Porsche's history in sports cars. But they were obviously fantastic cars to drive, weren't they?
Well, obviously, they were the most wonderful cars. We had the 936, which was not a bad car, but of course it was outdated by then. So the coupes from Renault, and they were quicker already. You know, they just had too many little glitches go wrong, so they didn't beat us off. But no, we had, you know, Singer already thought then to make a new car to replace the 936. And this was the 956. And I drove the 936 in Castellet. I think I told the story quite often. And then he said, okay, stop. They've got the 956 now, and you drive that one now. And I said, great. So we sit in it. And with the 936, it was funny, you know, it was still a circuit where you had to watch certain corners. You know, it was aerodynamically good, but not as grippy as the other ones, the 956s and 962s. So you had this fast S after the pits, fairly long, straight, and then you had this, and that S you had to take precisely. You know, you had to take it, you know, really fully concentrated so you could take it flat, which we all did finally. But it took Waddy, for an example. It took him, when he drove for Porsche, the race, it took him 2 days to take it flat because he couldn't get himself to do it. And I said, do it, Waddy. I said, we all do it. You can do it. And so finally he did it, of course. But, you know, then I jumped into the 956, and you sit in a new car and you look at the instrumentation and the way everything is. So it's not that dissimilar to the other one, but anyway, and then you go out and you accelerate fast and you go down the road, and then you end up in the bottom of the circuit where you have a double right and the fast kink, the fast left one, and the 2 kilometer straight. And I arrived and I said, hold it. I said, did I take a shortcut? I couldn't remember certain corners. They weren't there anymore with this car. There were no more corners. Incredible. Was good. So, you know, when I came in just for a checkup, quickly, if everything was right and solid and no leaks anywhere, and I said, No, but I don't know. But that car is so damn good. It drives completely different. I don't recognize the circuit anymore. And so on. So it was quite funny. Mm. You know, you still couldn't take the top end in senior, you know, after the long straight, you have this fast 90-degree right-hander. And I wanted to do it flat, but we didn't quite do it flat. And I'm not quite sure the speed we've done after coming along, you know, flat out, obviously, the 2 kilometers straight. And I think we probably did 360, something like that. We must have done. And so I didn't take it flat. We probably only did it with the miserly 340 or so, which is nothing. Yeah. No, but it's the car was intriguing. And, you know, it was so nice, responsive in terms of when you made some small alterations. You know, when you had a bit of, in Hockenheim, for an example, I spoke to Norbert in qualifying. I was quickest. I said, Norbert, I've got a slight understeer in the east Ostkurve, the east corner. Can we lower the front end a little bit? He said, Jochen, we raise it a bit. I said, raise it. He said, try it. So they did that. Minimal. I mean, and it was better. And it was a simple thing. These aerodynamics, the way they worked. So you, by raising the front end, you allowed more air to come under the car, and it got the greater mass of air got compressed earlier. So it got compressed and then it accelerated earlier through the underfloor to the back of the car. So it gave you more downforce or more grip on the front end of the car. So you could, and he knew all that from his wind tunnels. And, you know, and then he translated it into the car on the track. It was fantastic. I said, and lots of other tuners, you know, Kramer, he was also, they worked on a complete different principle. They always thought they could improve the worst cars by giving it a big splitter in front to work with a mechanical grip more than anything else, big rear wing and so on. And I drove this car a little while ago, 3 or 4 years ago Laguna Seca. It was Bruce Levin's car, which Klaus Ludwig at the time drove. And it was typical Kramer, and the car was quick and it was okay, but it was twitchy. It was not forgiving and so on. So that was the difference between our cars that were much nicer to drive, much more predictable and things like that. And they were as quick, but they didn't seem to be so edgy, you know, like the other one and so on. So that was quite intriguing. And, you know, to work with an engineer like Norbert Singer was just fantastic, you know, because he really put you onto the fine points which he worked out in the wind tunnel. And then you felt it and you felt the improvement. And that's nice, you know, that's the mark of a, I mean, he made a car which was, even today, it would be quick still. Okay, less so, I agree. But it's still, you know, the last one, the 962 in the latest version had a very refined, I still haven't driven it because I was really, was Mercedes and all that, but the car never raced. That car never raced. They just tested it and it was too good. And I still would like to drive it one of these, maybe this year, maybe next year, yeah. Somewhere. Yeah, when we have a chance.
Well, that sounds like a potential Motorsport Magazine article for Joe Dunn, the editor, to organise and get you in that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Carl, we've been talking a bit about Norbert Singer there. We did a recording with him quite recently, actually, for this Porsche series. Yeah. How instrumental was he to all of that Porsche success back in the 80s and 90s? And because he was there. He was even worked on the 917. You know, I mean, an extraordinary career he had.
Look, you had, obviously, Professor Bott, who was the head of Weiser, who was instrumental first to make the decision to work this way or that way. And Norbert Singer was the engineer who put it all together. And without Norbert Singer, the company would have not been where it is now. It would have been much later, you know, than everything. And Singer was just a brilliant engineer, very nice person to work with. And these guys, you know, you have Rory Byrne, for an example, the designer was in Formula One. You had Patrick Head, you know, who was also quite philosophers, and they loved other things. And, you know, these, they always struck me as very modest sort of people. You know, they're not boasting around and I'm the greatest and this and that. I mean, far not. They were very quiet and they knew what they knew, and they knew they could interpret the things. So they needed also some drivers to work with them closely and to make them understand what he would like to have, the driver, so he could implement that a bit later and so on. And it's fantastic, you know. It's a great gift. I think the good engineers, they're rarer than drivers. You know, you have happy-go-lucky drivers who sit in the car and they're quick and so on, but they're not very analytical in their sort of switchback information and feelings and this and that. And some are very good, some are not so hot and so on. But the engineers, they're fantastic. They are really, really good. And if you have a very expressive driver, Jackie Stewart, I mean, and Taranak and these guys, you know, wonderful, wonderful combinations of driver, engineers, designers, and that's what you need. And then you become successful. But you also have to work with the drivers and the engineers. So this doesn't happen overnight. So it sometimes needs 2 or 3 or 4 years even, you know, to get this combination really ticking properly and so on. So that's it's very intriguing. Mm-hmm. I like to work with, or I always have liked to work with engineers who are on a similar wavelength philosophically than I was. So you could talk about different things. You don't always have to talk about cars, and but you still got to the point. And that was very, very, how should I say, it was a very humbling experience too. You think, you know, it's just little things and they make such a world of a difference.
Yeah.
It's nice.
It's interesting you say that, because I've always thought that you would have worked brilliantly with Patrick Head. Not only do you both share a love of the sea, but, you know, twice you missed out on a Williams drive, you know, that you could have been there with Patrick Head.
I know, I regret it to the end of my days.
Sorry to bring it up on a Sunday morning.
No, sure. It was really a pity that I didn't do it. It was, you know, when, I mean, Jackie Oliver and the Arrows and, you know, our Tony Southgate, they were also good guys. They were also nice. Yeah. Southgate was a very good engineer, but a bit stubborn when he was in a sort of a cul-de-sac. He didn't turn around. So he tried to find an exit for that and to continue. And anyway, and for an example with him, with the funny patent pending car we had, which was aerodynamically quite advanced, really. We have to give it to them. And but we were sprung totally wrong. The springs were far too soft. So we had all the downforce and the car started porpoising all the time.
Wasn't it? You were using 380-pound springs rather than 2,400 or something like that.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just a little lightly sprung.
It was a different 10
league.
Times almost. 10 times.
I must ask some of these readers questions. There's one here from Michael Skeet. It's quite interesting because obviously you raced a fair amount in America in sports cars, which I quite want to talk to you about. He's asking, did you ever test drive an Indy car and think about forging a career over there?
Then we're back at Porsche. Yes, we did all the development. I drove the Porsche Indy car first in Weiser, then in Castellet. We did the whole season developing. And I was offered by Porsche to run the car in Tamiami Trail in Miami, in Florida. And of course, I couldn't do it because I didn't have the time to need a fortnight to do your rookie test. And I knew that, so I knew I couldn't do it. I wasn't allowed to do it. But I regretted it because I really wanted to race in the States then. And it was something with the contracts and with Al Holbert, who was really in charge of Porsche Motorsport in the States. And we didn't get on at all, honestly not. And he never told me a straight thing in the eye. He just circumvented it. And he said, I give you a call. Good to know that you want to drive next year. Good to know, he said. I give you a call November, December, January. I waited. Then I got hold of him again. Oh, he said, oh, I'm glad that you called me. I said, yes. And he said, oh, I've just signed Theo Fabi yesterday, this sort of thing. I said, you're such a honestly. I mean, it was so annoying anyway. So I don't have to talk bad about him. I don't want to. He was, let's say, a very manipulative character. So anyway, and pity. But he was, other than that, he was a very good driver and so on. But I watched him drive the car and he drove deliberately slow. That's what I could see from the outside in Miami then. And I told Singer, because he wanted a different chassis. He wanted a Dallara or a March or Lola, can't remember. Either way, but he didn't want the Porsche chassis. I don't know why not. And the Porsche was in the beginning a little bit tricky because there was a lot of joints, you know, a lot of things when there was too much friction under load, so they didn't work. It didn't work freely enough. And so they put in needle bearings, small ones, into all these sort of necessary connections, and then it became better and better. At the end, the car was very, very good. And in Weissach, it was quicker than Niki's Formula One. You know, Niki with the Formula One was slower than this Indy car. And I thought that car would have deserved to run in Indy because it would have been a bloody good car. But I don't know. The politics stopped it. And this was really pity. Yeah.
Sticking with America, you won the 1987 Sebring 12 Hours with Bobby Rahal. Obviously, Bobby was such a kind of a hero of American motorsport. What was he like to drive with? What was he like as a person?
Bobby drove much of the season against each other, and I usually beat him, you know. And he was a heck of a nice guy. Bobby was super, super nice, very cool. And now we got on very well, and you know, I had no grudge. You know, if it would have been quicker, but he wasn't necessarily quicker than I was. But he was a very good driver. So, you know, the 12-hour Sebring is always a bit of a tricky tricky track, so you have to be aware of all the little sort of unfortunate bumps and cracks and whatever on the track, not to destroy your car too early, not to overload it with undue stress, and so on. So Bobby was very good with that. He was a good driver. Yeah.
Now, you know, despite all your Le Mans 24 hours races in Porsches, it took a Sauber Mercedes for you to win it in 89. What were the big differences between not just the car, but also going from Porsche to the Sauber team? Was it a big change, or was it actually all quite natural?
No, the Porsche team was very professional. The cars were very good and so on. And we should have won it. I mean, with Bellof, we should have won it too, because we were leading and Jackie had a bit of a problem early in the race. So we were leading, you know, and by a lap, and we kept that lead for most of the race. And then some trivial things in the engine, some gasket nonsense and so on. We had water in the oil and da-da-da-da from the water-cooled heads. And a pity. So twice we had similar small problems where I could have won with Porsche already and should have won. But anyway, should have, could have, you know, that one. But when I then got to Mercedes, to Sauber, Sauber was super nice man, but it was a small team. I mean, it was incredible. For example, we had practice in Silverstone, and I said, this was in 88, and I said, I would love to drive now. Or can I, sitting in the car? He said, no, Jochen, you have to wait till the other car comes in. We don't have enough people to run two cars on the track at the same time. I said, excuse me. But that's the way it was, you know. So, but the car's aerodynamics with Leo Ress, who was a very good engineer too, it was a good combination. And I think the car was just one step ahead again of the Porsches aerodynamically and the way it was built. I mean, the old C9 was still half aluminium, half carbon, or less than half. And so the car was quite forgiving, but then we also ran funny tires, we know that. And that didn't quite work well together. The tire combination with the chassis and the springing and all that, that was needed a bit of work. And, you know, we tested in Jerez, which was great. And I asked Peter Sauber, I said, have you ever done any shock absorber tests? You know, he said, never. I said, let's go, let's do it. In Hockenheim, then we had Bilstein, they came up and so on, and then we had 2 days to try things differently. And the same people were very good, the engineers, they were very together and very imaginative. So because the adjustment of the damping is very critical, you have the high frequency, the low frequency, you have the middle frequency, you have all these little valves inside which allow, you know, the damper to work in a certain way, in certain certain speeds. And they could do that well, and they had all the machines to put them in and to memorize it and all that. It was brilliant. So we had a very good car after that. It was nice. And, you know, the springing, the damping is so important to work also with the tires. If you have a tire which is too soft in the sidewalls and too hard to spring or damping, it doesn't work because the tire is flexing too much. And so on. And that doesn't, you know, so you need either a different tire or set up the car completely different again. Less downforce, because with this massive amount of downforce at this very high speeds, it's intriguing. You know, you gain what, 3 tons, 4 tons of weight, you know, it's 350, 380, 400 kilometers. So that can break the car and it can break the tire for sure. So that was something which had to be worked out. And there I was lacking a little bit. I was missing Norbert Singer as well. He was, very, he was, let's say, more experienced than Leo.
If I could just pause for a moment, I hope you're all enjoying this series of Porsche podcasts. And I just wanted to thank our partner, Princess Yachts, without whom we wouldn't be able to do these. So thank you so much to them. Princess Yachts has been a long-term supporter of Motorsport Magazine, and it's great to have them on board for these podcasts, which really have become a part of modern-day motorsport. Much like the one with the green cover, Princess Yachts epitomises the best of British manufacturing, and you can really see that in every one of its products. Every yacht is designed with an amazing forward-thinking mentality, and you must head to princessyachts.com to have a look at what this extraordinary company does on a daily basis. You mentioned Stefan Beloff there. My age group always hears how amazing Stefan Beloff was and how he would have been a future world champion. What was your experience of him when you raced with him and against him?
Look, first you have to prove it. You have to live through the years to become champion and so on. And if you are too reckless in certain ways, I don't want to talk bad about Stefan. He had a lot of talent, obviously, and he was a very good driver, sure. But he was, of course, made larger than life after his accident. And that's typical, that afterwards he said, oh, he would have been, he would have been quicker than Senna, he would have been quicker than Schumacher, he would have been. I said, guys, it's pretty academic to talk like that. In order to survive racing, you have to have respect for what you do as a driver, and the respect towards the other guys on the circuit as well. So don't just think that you are, Fangio said it once, he said, must always try to be the best, but never believe that you are.
Yeah.
Always strive to be and so on. But if you come in with an attitude and you think, easy, this, easy, that, you all have a certain amount of this sort of attitude within you, otherwise you don't need to race. But you still have to respect the thing, what you do. It's dangerous. It's fast. It's much more fun to finish a race than crashing. I can assure you that. This sort of message didn't get through to all of them. So some guys were pretty reckless, and that's a pity.
Yeah. Now, to go back to these questions, I did find that question about your contract finally. That was actually asked by someone called Chris Phillips. Michael Skeet, who asked the IndyCar America question, he's also wondering whether there's any plans for an English edition of your autobiography, because it would make a fantastic read.
Yes, I'd love to. I'd love to have that, yeah.
There's one here from Michael, who's got it's a surname I'm not going to begin to pronounce because I'll just get it wrong and it'll be very embarrassing. How would you compare Emerson and James as teammates? And then there's a second question. What did you consider most difficult or challenging at Le Mans? I think we probably sort of slightly covered that, Michael, earlier in the podcast. But let's go for the Emerson versus James as teammates.
I can only judge it from my relationship with Emerson first. It was, I respected him a lot, great driver, but he was also a good politician and so on and so on. Don't forget, he was already world champion when he came to the team. And there I was sort of in my second year of racing, really, with him. And he realized too that I got under the light of things, same engines, more or less, slight differences. But I got up to par with him in speed quite often. And I think he realized that too. Don't forget, he's been already quite a number of years, and he's been through all this sort of fantastic successes and all that. So that's why he sort of split. And I think with James, it would have been very much the same. I think he would have quit the team, Emerson. I don't think he would have liked to run with James, because if James would have been the obvious favorite driver in the team, Emerson would have never accepted that because he was the kingpin. You know, he had brought more or less the sponsorship with him because Marlboro Brazil was a big thing. And of course, you know, for McLaren too, they got good deals because of Emerson. And with James, that would have been probably the following year. But Emerson would have not stayed with James more than a year, for sure not.
Just on that note, you sort of helped with Ron Howard's Rush film. What did you make of that? Because you know, you were there, you were literally right in the thick of it. And what did you think of the finished article?
I think it was beautifully done. It's done. I think the acting was pretty good. Chris Hemsworth did a very good job with James, and you know, and Brühl, the young Austrian, he was also brilliant. Brilliant with Nicky and so on. So it was, from a film point, from the filming, it was beautiful. The story itself, okay, was interesting enough. But to me, having been sort of in it at the time, I looked at it slightly with a skew eye and I thought, But, you know, don't forget, James only won the championship because of Nicky's accident. He would have not won it. And, you know, James never looked at it like that. Sort of he took it, beating his chest, and it was him. He was very lucky. He was a good driver, of course, but he was very much favored within the team, with me and him. And, you know, when we had this sort of story from Keith Douglas later, that they had 70 horsepowers more, we don't have to repeat that. That made me afterwards think, and I thought, damn it. This sort of thing. You know, sort of. But it's normal. There was the three guys. It was Andretti, Scheckter, this was the Tyrrell, of course, and the Lotus and McLaren. So suddenly they went, they lapped us. These three guys, they were always ahead of us. And we thought, we forgot how to drive. I mean, Emerson with his Copasuka, he was not in the game anymore anyway because the car was not good enough. But, you know, some other drivers too. And it's just, anyway. And then later when after I stopped with McLaren, I drove the ATS, which was a fatal mistake, nearly fatal. And so then I should have driven for Frank Williams. And, you know, all the years he spoke to me, I said, Frank, but your cars are not so hot in the moment. I'm still with McLaren. So obviously, you know, I like the guy a lot because we met quite often with Brody, you know, the other driver and some other guys, you know, and it was a nice group of friends. And Frank was a very nice character. And so on. So even Alan Jones came along. He said, drive for us next year. Drive with me, you know. I said, yes, I'd love to. Let me. And then Jackie Oliver came and he had the Warsteiner money from Germany. So that was, and they said, oh, they pay me so much and blah, blah, blah. And Frank said, I've got the okay from the Saudis, but I don't have it in writing yet. So I can't give it to you in writing until, let's say, in the 4 weeks' time when they come back, you know, to work or whatever. And so Jackie had the bait way out. So, you know, I signed for them. But don't forget, it was Tony Southgate's car and it was Ricardo Patrese who was quite quick with the... with the arrows. And so I thought, can't be that bad. So obviously. So unfortunately, then I missed it. And then later, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
On the Ron Howard topic, I went to go and watch that being filmed at Crystal Palace, Rush. And I actually ended up being thrown off the set, which is a story for another day. But before I did, I asked Ron Howard, is he going to find it difficult to make a film about Formula One when he doesn't really watch or like Formula One. And he replied to me, which I still think is one of the all-time greatest replies. He said, and obviously he was a director of Apollo 13.
Yeah,
and he said,
yeah.
Well, I've never been to the moon. Which I thought was quite good. I wanted to go back to the Sauber Mercedes years. Because by then, you know, you weren't an elder statesman, but you were one of the sort of the leading drivers, and you were kind of, in some part, a mentor to Wendlinger, Frentzen, and Schumacher. And I'm sure I heard you say somewhere that actually, really, in terms of natural talent, Frentzen kind of was the standout of that three for you.
Yeah,
is that right?
When the guys came, they tested, and each one had a slight different approach. And so on, and I could see they were very quick. Frentzen was probably the most spontaneous, easy come, easy go guy, and he was very fast, instantly. And Michael took a little more time to set the car to his liking and to work with it a little bit, and so on. And then Wendlinger was a little more cautious. Carl, and he took the longest to do similar times. But he was quick anyway. I mean, he was very quick, but it took him a bit longer to get there. And Michael liked to play with the car and to change this, change that. So there's something he saw and he felt where he could improve, you know, and so on. And time proved him right at the end. You know, it was, he was, let's say, the most critical and the most... the most meticulous driver we had in the car, for sure.
No, we are slowly running out of time, but I just wanted to kind of bring everything up to date and ask you about Le Mans today, because, you know, one of your things that you weren't too keen on at Le Mans in your day was, you know, you weren't going flat out, whereas nowadays, you know, it is a 24-hour sprint. Do you think you would have enjoyed today's hybrid cars?
Yeah, of course, sure. But, you know, I find Le Mans now with the chicanes and the straight and all the chicane over the Dunlop Brow and all this, it's more dangerous now than it was then, because there are too many changes on the track that, for you as a driver. You go from the left to the right to the left, and you stay right, you enter to the left-hander, you know, the second chicane, the first chicane, you enter to the right. And it's always points where you had quite a few crashes. Quite a few get-togethers, and of course the mixture of cars is also such. They have this high downforce, amazing cars. they don't look much good, but they are very effective, very, very efficient, and you know, they're amazing. So you drive them flat out, you know, for 24 hours, and that's something, you know, we still had to watch it a bit. When I drove with Michael. No, I didn't drive with Michael, but I mean, he drove the other car and he was going very fast. And I said to him, because we drove the same hours, I said, Michael, I think you drive a little too quick. He said, may seem quick to you, for me, it's nothing. I said, I was second by then. Anyway, so I said, Michael, it's not your speed, damn it. It's the load of the car at that speed that you risk that you have a problem later, because if you go that fast, you know, you get wheel bearings, you have all sort of with brakes perhaps, or God knows what. So that's exactly what happened later. And he came along and he said, I think you were right, Johan. I think I went too quick. I said, well, I'm glad that you say it. But no, he was good with that. He sort of, yeah. But anyway, Le Mans, now, yes, I would like to do it, but you're 3-4 guys in the car, 3 minimum. Because don't forget, these cars are very harsh, they're very hard. And, you know, there's no creature comfort. The seats are hard and the suspension and everything. And because of, you know, it's not very bumpy, the track, luckily. But still, you know, you have this sort of, and it works on you, and it wears you out quite easily. So you have to be super fit. And it helps when you're light, you know, when you're lightweight. You bounce less, you know, as when you put on when you put a lot of weight into the car and you're in your shape. So anyway, yeah.
Counts me out. So I think it would be nice to end on a reader's question here. We've got one from Matt Stelmacher. He's wondering what your favourite corner is at any circuit in the world, and in which car was it most thrilling or satisfying to get right?
Usually I liked fast corners. You know, you had a fantastic one in Mexico, the Peraltada, whatever it was called, long right-hander. You had Monza, was beautiful. I liked that. You know, Monza was fantastic, the Curva Grande. You had, and then you had the Lesmos, the two beautiful corners. And then the Ascari, the old one before the chicane. Then, of course, you had the long right-hander before start and finish. It's got a name, I forgot. Anyway, Spa. Spa was fantastic. The beautiful corners. You know, it's something, you know, which I always liked fast corners better than slow ones, because the slow ones were more technical and technical stuff I wanted to drive. And the fast corners were fantastic. It was good. No, it was nice. It was, you know, yet Watkins Glen, I quite like too, but Watkins Glen was highly, highly dangerous because of the nature of the guardrails. It was very soft steel, very soft. And so whenever a car hit it, it sort of flexed completely and it opened up and not good. And but other than that, it was a beautiful circuit. And of course, the oval racing, you know, in Daytona, depending on the car, of course, you know, if you have a fast car, it's more exciting than a slowish one because then you nearly fall off the banking. But racing is good as long as you move fast. There's a peace in speed I never found in stillness.
What a wonderful line to end on. Jochen, I feel as I've held you up enough already, because you'll be due your Sunday lunch and you haven't had a single drink of your Prosecco. I'm very impressed that you've got through this entire hour without touching
your drink. It's looking at me the whole time.
And it's winking at you now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, cheers. Jochen, thank you so much. It's been absolutely fantastic. It always is with you.
We'll
see you hopefully at some Goodwood events this year, I would have thought. Festival of Speed, Revival members meeting.
That would be lovely, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm set to go to all of them. Let's just hope that it happens.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. But thank you to Jochen. Thank you also to Alan Hyde, who's in the background making these things sound a lot better than we actually are. And thank you to all of us, the readers and the listeners and the viewers. We'll be back soon with another Motorsport Magazine podcast. Thank you very much. Bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.